Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're speaking to you now from the parlor of the Executive Mansion in Albany, New York, where we are about to listen to the Honorable Franklin D. Roosevelt, Governor of the State of New York and Democratic nominee for the presidency of the United States. As many of you know, Governor Roosevelt did not wait for the usual formal notification ceremonies many weeks after his nomination, but broke all precedents by flying from Albany to the Democratic National Convention itself at Chicago on July 2nd. He was then and there formally notified, delivered his speech of acceptance, and announced that so far as he was concerned, the campaign was already underway. Tonight, the governor is making his first radio address over a national broadcasting company nationwide network and will speak for the next half hour on the subject of the Democratic platform adopted in Chicago. It is now my privilege to introduce the Honorable Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Governor of the State of New York, Democratic nominee for president.
Good evening, my fellow Americans and friends of the radio audience. I hope during this campaign to use the radio frequently to speak to you about important things that concern us all. In the olden days, campaigns were conducted amid surroundings of brass bands and red lights. Oratory was an appeal primarily to the emotions and sometimes to the passions. But it has always been my feeling that with the spread of education, with the wider reading of newspapers, and especially with the advent of the radio, mere oratory and mere emotion are having less to do with the determination of public questions under our representative system of government. Today, common sense plays the greater part, and final opinions are more often arrived at in the quiet of the home. In this quiet of common sense and friendliness, I want you to hear me tonight as I sit here in my own home, away from the excitement of the campaign, and with only a few of the family and a few personal friends present. I am weighing all of the things that I have learned in all my years of public service, first in Albany 21 years ago, then during 8 busy years in Washington, which were interspersed with visits into all of the states of the Union, and during and after the war to the nations of Europe, and then in these latter years in my tasks as governor of New York. In order that the way may be clear for the more detailed discussion and debate that will come as the campaign proceeds, I propose tonight to state the broad policies of my party, to sketch what might be called the first outline of the final picture. Where do we look for this? In the platform, of course. A platform is a proposal, and at the same time, it is a promise binding on the party and on its candidates. Now, it is true that even the partisan opposition press has found it very hard to criticize the Democratic platform this year. It is brief, only 1/5 of the length of the Republican platform, and it is easily understood. 80% of it is constructive. Only 20% of it is critical. Moreover, it is forthright and genuine, honest to the core. The entire platform needs to be read in the light of its short preamble. This indicates that our present economic condition, how it came, what it is, and how it can be remedied, is the main issue of this campaign. I can do no better than to read it to you exactly as it stands. Here is the preamble. In this time of unprecedented economic and social distress, the Democratic Party declares its conviction that the chief causes of this condition were the disastrous policies pursued by our government since the World War, of economic isolation, fostering the merger of competitive businesses into monopolies, and encouraging the indefensible expansion and contraction of credit for private profit at the expense of the public. Those who are responsible for these policies have abandoned the ideals on which the war was won and have thrown away the fruits of victory, thus rejecting the greatest opportunity in history to bring peace, prosperity, and happiness to our people and to the world. They have ruined our foreign trade, destroyed the values of our commodities and products, crippled our banking system, robbed millions of our people of their life savings, and thrown millions more out of work, produced widespread poverty and brought the government to a state of financial distress unprecedented in times of peace. The only hope for improving present conditions, restoring employment, affording permanent relief to the people, and bringing the nation back to its former proud position of domestic happiness and of financial, industrial, agricultural, and commercial leadership in the world lies in a drastic change in economic and governmental policy. Believing that a party platform is a covenant with the people to be faithfully kept by the party when entrusted with power, and that the people are entitled to know in plain words the terms of the contract to which they are asked to subscribe, we hereby declare this to be the platform of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party solemnly promises, by appropriate action, to put into effect the principles, policies, and reforms herein advocated, and to eradicate the policies, methods, and practices herein condemned. That, my friends, is the preamble. Immediately after that statement of principle, there follow three important declarations. Here they are. First, an immediate and drastic reduction of governmental expenditures by abolishing useless commissions and offices, consolidating departments and bureaus, and eliminating extravagance to accomplish a saving of not less than 25% in the cost of federal government. And we call upon the Democratic Party in the states to make a zealous effort to achieve a proportionate result. Secondly, maintenance of the national credit by a federal budget annually balanced on the basis of accurate executive estimates within revenue raised by a system of taxation levied on the principle of ability to pay. Third, a sound currency to be preserved at all hazards, and an international monetary conference called on the invitation of our government to consider the rehabilitation of silver and related questions. With these declarations, my friends, for a balanced budget and for a sound currency, the Democratic Party sets its face against the time-serving, the disastrous fiscal policy of recent years. What did that policy do? First, in the highly prosperous times, from 1921 to 1929, when taxes were easy to obtain, the Republican leadership repealed taxes on abnormal profits and incomes, with the result that the war debt was not drastically reduced. Then, when the Depression began, the administration, instead of reducing annual expenses to meet decreasing revenues, became sponsor for deficits, which at the end of this fiscal year will have added the staggering sum of $5 billion to our American national debt. And finally, to meet this staggering deficit, the administration has resorted to the type of inflation which has weakened public confidence in our government credit, both at home and abroad. High-sounding, newly invented phrases cannot sugarcoat that pill. Let us have the courage to stop borrowing in order to meet continuing deficits. Let us stop the deficits themselves. Let us have equal courage to reverse the policy of the Republican leaders and insist on a sound currency. Our party says clearly that not only must government income meet prospective expenditures, but this income must be secured on the principle of ability to pay. That is a declaration in favor of graduated income, inheritance, and profit taxes, and against taxes on food and clothing, whose burden is actually shifted to the consumers of the necessities of life on a per capita basis rather than on the basis of the relative size of their personal income. Something more, I think, is needed than a domestic balanced budget and a just revenue system. Muddled government finance creates, of course, a general uncertainty concerning the value of national currencies. This uncertainty has a way of spreading from country to country, and we know today that the world is tormented with it. The United States could well afford to take the lead in asking for a general conference to establish less changeable fiscal relationships between countries. and to determine what can be done to restore the purchasing power of that half of the world's inhabitants who are on a silver basis, and to exchange views regarding governmental finance. It is obvious that sound money is an international necessity, not a domestic consideration for one nation alone. Nothing is more needed than such an exchange of opinion. Nothing could do more to create stable conditions in which trade, international trade, could once more be resumed. We face a condition that at first seems to involve either an unbalanced budget and an unsound currency, or else a failure of the government to assume its just duties. The relief of distress and protection against loss of savings that have been built up through many years by numberless small investors. That concerns you, my friends, who manage to lay aside a few dollars for the rainy day. This dilemma can be met by saving in one place what we would spend in others, or by acquiring the necessary revenue through taxation. Revenues must cover expenditures by one means or another. Any government, just like any family, can for a year spend a little more than it earns. But you and I know that a continuation of that habit means the poorhouse. At best, the federal government will necessarily bear a heavy burden. It has been the theory of Republican leaders that relief is a local responsibility, a theory stated repeatedly and modified only with the greatest reluctance. The Democratic platform was framed with an eye to actual human needs. What could be finer, for instance, than that bold and humanitarian statement pledging continuous responsibility of the government, meaning the federal government, for human welfare, especially for the protection of children? And in view of that statement, the plank concerning relief for the unemployed takes on a greater significance. Here it is. We advocate extension of federal credit to the states to provide unemployment relief wherever the diminishing resources of the states make it impossible for them to provide for the needy. Expansion of the federal program of necessary and useful construction affected with the public interest, such as flood control and waterways, including the St. Lawrence, Great Lakes, deep waterways. The spread of employment by a substantial reduction in the hours of labor. The encouragement of the shorter week by applying that principle in government service. Advanced planning of public works. And at the end of that section, there follows this. There is the party declaration concerning agriculture. Let me read that to you. We advocate for the restoration of agriculture, the nation's basic industry, better financing of farm mortgages through reorganized farm bank agencies at low rates of interest on an amortization plan, giving preference to credits for the redemption of farms and homes sold under foreclosure, extension and development of the farm cooperative movement, and effective control of crop surpluses so that our farmers may have the full benefit of the domestic market. Enactment of every constitutional measure that will aid the farmer to receive for basic farm commodities prices in excess of cost of production. And we condemn the extravagance of the Farm Board, its disastrous action which made the government a speculator in farm products, and the unsound policy of restricting agricultural production to the demands of domestic markets. At the end of that plank, the platform contains admirable statements also about a group of subjects that logically go together, the tariff and foreign policy. The tariff plank reads as follows. We advocate a competitive tariff for revenue, with a fact-finding tariff commission, free from executive interference, reciprocal tariff agreements with other nations, and an international economic conference designed to restore international trade and facilitate exchange. We condemn the Hawley-Smoot tariff law, the the prohibitive rates of which have resulted in retaliatory action by more than 40 countries, created international economic hostilities, destroyed international trade, driven our factories into foreign countries, robbed the American farmer of his foreign markets, and increased his cost of production. Now, my friends, a tariff is a tax laid on certain goods passing from the producer to the consumer. It's laid on these goods rather than on other similar ones because they originate abroad. This is obviously, of course, protection for the producers of competing goods at home. Peasants who live at lower levels than our farmers, workers who are sweated to reduce costs, ought not to determine prices for American-made goods. These are standards that we desire to set for ourselves. Tariffs should be high enough to maintain living standards which we set for ourselves. But if they are higher than that, they become a particularly vicious kind of direct tax which is laid doubly on the consumer. Not only are the prices of foreign goods raised, but those of domestic goods also. It is a difficult and highly technical matter to determine standards and costs of production abroad and at home. A commission of experts can be trusted to find such facts, but not to dictate policy. The facts should be left to speak for themselves, free from presidential interference. Right along this line, one of the great needs of the world, of course, is to set international trade flowing again. The proper procedure is to ascertain all of the pertinent facts, to publish them widely, and then to negotiate with each country affected. Trade barriers of all kinds ought to be lowered, not just by rule of thumb, but with due regard to safety and justice. Lowered nevertheless, lowered as quickly and as definitely as possible. Policy needs to be dominated by the realities that we discover and by the national purposes that we seek. This tariff policy, however, cannot be separated from our other relations with foreign countries. Remember that the whole thing ties in together. And the Democratic platform is explicit here also. It says, we advocate a firm foreign policy, including peace with all the world and the settlement of international disputes by arbitration, no interference in the internal affairs of other nations, the sanctity of treaties, and the maintenance of good faith and of goodwill in financial obligations, adherence to the World Court with the pending reservations, the Pact of Paris, abolishing war as an instrument of national policy, to be made effective by provisions for consultation and conference in case of threatened violation of treaties, international agreement for reduction of armaments, and cooperation with nations of the Western Hemisphere to maintain the spirit of the Monroe Doctrine. We oppose cancellation of the debts owing to the United States by foreign nations. That's the end of that paragraph. And let me add this. This problem of the debts is complex. Its solution has, however, been brought measurably nearer by the recent results at Lausanne. Great Britain and France and Germany have at last agreed among themselves concerning reparations. The danger now is that they and other nations may turn a united front against us. This comes, I am convinced, not so much from the debts that they owe us as from our barriers against their trade, which make the problem so difficult for them. The debts will not be a problem. We shall not have to cancel them if we are realistic about providing ways in which payment is made possible for them through the profits arising from the rehabilitation of trade as a whole. The Republican platform said nothing at all about this, but their position has been the absurd one of demanding payment and at the same time making payment impossible. This policy finally forced a moratorium, as it was bound to do. Our policy declares for payment, But at the same time, it declares for lower tariffs and resumption of trade that open the way to Europe to pay us. Up to this point, you and I have been considering both the immediate relief for the present emergency and also the immediate initiating of plans to bring us back to a more normal economic condition. At the same time, it is equally our duty to guard against a repetition of the evils and the errors which have cost us so much in the past decade. It is not enough to say that when prosperity is restored, we shall then consider how to avoid repeating all the old errors. Today, we recognize, we know these errors. Today, they should be outlawed for all time to come. It must be made more difficult for a depression to happen in the future. It must be made impossible for its indefensible features to show themselves again. And concerning the necessary revision of some of our institutions for this purpose, I am going to have more to say later on. At present, let me read you the party's stand in the platform. It advocates strict and impartial enforcement of the antitrust laws to prevent monopoly and unfair trade practices and revision thereof for the better protection of labor and the small producer and distributor, conservation, development, and use of the nation's water power in the public interest, protection of the investing public by requiring to be filed with the government and carried in all advertisements of all offerings of foreign and domestic stocks and bonds, true information as to bonuses and commissions, principal invested, and the interests of the seller, regulation to the full extent of federal power for first holding companies that sell securities in interstate commerce, secondly, rates of utility companies operating across state lines, and third, exchanges that are trading in securities and commodities. Quicker methods of realizing on assets for the relief of depositors in suspended banks, and a more rigid supervision of national banks for the protection of depositors and the prevention of the use of their monies in speculation to the detriment of local credits. It advocates also the severance of affiliated securities companies and the divorce of underwriting schemes from commercial banks, and further restriction of Federal Reserve banks in permitting the use of Federal Reserve facilities for speculative purposes. It condemns action and utterances of high public officials designed to influence stock exchange prices. It condemns the usurpation of power by the State Department in assuming to pass on foreign securities offered by international bankers, as a result of which, billions of dollars in questionable bonds have been sold to the public upon the implied approval of the federal government. And now, my friends, we come to the famous repeal plan. It is simple, and it has meaning. It says, we favor the repeal of the 18th Amendment. To effect such repeal, we demand that the Congress immediately propose a constitutional amendment to truly representative conventions in the states called to act solely on that proposal. We urge the enactment of such measures by the several states as will actually promote temperance, effectively prevent the return of the saloon, and bring the liquor traffic into the open under complete supervision and control by the states. We demand that the federal government effectively exercise its power to enable the states to protect themselves against importation of intoxicating liquors in violation of their laws. And pending repeal, we favor immediate modification of the Volstead Act to legalize the manufacture and sale of beer and other beverages of such alcoholic content as is permissible under the Constitution, and to provide therefrom a proper and needed revenue. That is the end of that plank. Nothing needs to be added to that, except this, that if the present Congress takes no action, I shall urge the new Congress to carry out these provisions. There are a number of other planks of importance, but less in need of elaboration, which, because my time is so short, I shall only have time to read to you. They are as follows. We advocate a navy and an army adequate for national defense, based on a survey of all facts affecting the existing establishment, that the people in time of peace may not be burdened by an expenditure fast approaching $1 billion annually. The fullest measure of justice and generosity for all war veterans who have suffered disability or distress caused by or resulting from actual service in time of war and for their dependents. Unemployment and old age insurance under state laws. Independence for the Philippines. Ultimate statehood for Puerto Rico. The employment of American citizens in the operation of the Panama Canal. Simplification of legal procedure and reorganization of the judicial system to make the attainment of justice speedy and certain and at less cost. Continuous publicity of political contributions and expenditures. Strengthening of the Corrupt Practices Act and severe penalties for misappropriation of campaign funds. We condemn the improper and excessive use of money in political activities. We condemn paid lobbies of special interests to influence members of Congress and other public servants by personal contact. And we condemn the open and covert resistance of administrative officials to every effort made by congressional committees to curtail the extravagant expenditures of the government and to revoke improvident subsidies granted to favored interests. That, my friends, completes the platform. But before I close my talk with you tonight, let me end with this concluding declaration. To accomplish these purposes, to recover economic liberty, we pledge the nominees of this convention and the best effort of a great party whose founder announced the doctrine which guides us now. In the hour of our country's need, equal rights to all, special privileges to none.
You have just listened to the Honorable Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Governor of the State of New York and Democratic nominee for the Presidency of the United States, in an address explaining the platform adopted by his party at Chicago. The governor spoke to you in the presence of his family and a few intimate friends from the parlor of the Executive Mansion in Albany, New York. The broadcast came to you through the facilities of the National Broadcasting Company.
At this time, we present a short musical interlude.